Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There is a bomb waiting to go off, deeply embedded in our financial system. Corporate debt is at an all-time high. Personal debt is at an all-time high as well. Banksters are now doing with mortgages what they, back in 2008, what they were doing with mortgages that blew up our economy. They're doing that now with corporate debt, and packaging it, slicing and dicing it, and selling it off as AAA-rated investments when none of the debt in it is even A-rated. Is this going to blow up in our face? Not to mention the fact that everybody's predicting that there's a huge wave of corporate bankruptcies, particularly small and medium-sized companies, coming down the road in a matter of months when all this federal support runs out. What the hell is going on? Where is this going to lead us? Professor Richard Wolff is with us, the economist and co-founder of Democracy at Work, the author of numerous books. His most recent, Understanding Socialism, democracyatwork.info is the website. He also, his personal website, rdwolf with two Fs, .com. You can tweet him at profwolf with two Fs or at democracy@WRK. Professor Wolff, welcome back. Your thoughts on what's the state of debt with, and I also saw a piece that I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal this morning saying that worldwide debt has now exceeded 100% of GDP. What's going on?
Well, I think you're seeing, and I hesitate to say it, but it has to be said, I think you're seeing the unraveling of a system. I'm a critic of capitalism, so I could, I suppose, say I told you so. I take no pleasure in it at all, but I think that's what you're seeing. So let me explain. The crash of 2008 and 9 is called the Great Recession because it was, at that time, the second worst crash of capitalism in its history after the Great Depression of the 1930s. One of the major ways that the United States government tried in panic in those last 4 months of 2008 to deal with it was by pumping huge amounts of money into the economy, which continued in 2009 and 10, and dropping interest rates to unprecedented lows. Here we are, 11 years later, 10 years later, depending on how you count, and what do we got? Another crash of capitalism. But this one has within it, and on top of it, the scars from the last one. What do I mean? When you drop interest rates to virtually zero in the aftermath of 2008, you are sending an invitation to every corporation, every business in the United States, and similar things happened elsewhere, but particularly here. The invitation is, whatever problem your company has, whatever difficulty you've encountered, you now know that the easiest, quickest, and cheapest way to deal with your problem is to go borrow virtually free money. Money that you can get from the banks and ultimately from the Federal Reserve at 1%, 1.5%, 2%, way less than ever before. To the surprise of no one, the corporate sector in America, business, borrowed money over the last decade beyond anything anyone had ever seen before. Good companies, bad companies, and all in between, loaded up on this free money to solve whatever problem they had. And of course, since it's capitalism, amongst these companies were crooks and hustlers and speculators of all kinds, who also, of course, took advantage of the low income, the low cost money, borrowing for very dubious and highly risky investments. They all could keep going unless and until something happened to bring us kind of sharply up against the fact that the underlying businesses that had borrowed weren't in a position to repay. We would have had that in the crash that began in February of this year, the downturn of capitalism, which is normal. But if this one is not only bad, but on top of it, the pandemic, now we have the great danger that many, many businesses will go out, and therefore the arrangement that we can handle a few bankruptcies is now threatened by a more wholesale declaration of inability to pay, and that is even bigger because of all this borrowing than what we saw back in 2008. Bottom line, nothing was learned, the same or parallel games were played, and we are now living out the risks that flowed from the way we panicked and responded in 2008.
I absolutely get that, and I share your critique of capitalism. The system, however, is probably not going to change in the next few years, at least not in any big consequential way. I'm wondering if, I mean, we used to regulate debt in the United States. I believe it was Richard Nixon who did away with federal usury laws prior to the late to the early 1970s. It was illegal to charge more than 10% interest. He blew that off. And as I recall, the ability of banks to, or any third party, to buy and tranche and resell debt, as we saw with CDOs, with the real estate market in 2008, as we're seeing now with collateralized loan obligations, CLOs, with the corporate debt market, the ability to do that, that was illegal prior to the Reagan administration. I mean, this all came about as a consequence of this great experiment of Reaganism, did it not? Aren't there some things that we can do to mitigate the damage and the danger going forward?
Yeah, it's just we're a little bit of, you know, closing the barn door after all the livestock have left. At this point, we are facing, I mean, let me give you an example that sort of answers your questions. In the months of April and May, we now know a little under half of all commercial establishments did not pay their rent to whoever their landlord was, the building in which their store was located, the mall in which their store was located. Half. That is a spectacular default, much greater than the population or the working class people not paying rent on their apartments is the commercial enterprises who didn't. Okay, the landlords are therefore screwed in this arrangement. What do? The landlords inform the banks in the United States, from whom they've borrowed to build the mall, to own the building and so on, that they can't pay off their debts to the banks because as landlords they're not getting the rents upon which they depend. So the landlords are hiring lawyers to threaten eviction to the tenants. The bankers are hiring lawyers to go to court against the landlords. This is a system, and I don't mean this rhetorically, I mean it in empirical detail. The system is falling apart. None of the normal lease arrangements, none of the normal handshake obligations, recognized bills paid, that's not happening anymore. That's a complete disintegration of what normally holds a society together. So I think you're right. We can't just keep talking about capitalism. But in a sense, I don't have to anymore because the immediate realities that businesses and individuals face, 42 million on getting unemployment, court cases filling up with God knows how many evictions of both commercial and household tenants. This is the kind of thing that happens when empires fall apart. And I suspect it is of a seriousness that really will put the system as a whole into question a lot sooner than any of us thought.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. Professor Wolf, it's always so great talking with you. Thank you so much for dropping by today.
Thank you, Tom.
Professor Richard Wolf, democracyatwork.info, and his most recent book, Understanding Socialism, rdwolf2fs.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So do you think that our economy is going to survive? And frankly, if Joe Biden becomes president or anybody, I mean, can we fix this? Dennis in Bergenfield, New Jersey. Hey, Dennis.
Actually, it's about supply-side economics. I understand the criticism that it increases income inequality and it fails to generate the promised government revenue through economic growth. My question to you is, what are your biggest issues with it? Or trickle-down?
Well, supply-side economics is a scam. I mean, that's my biggest concern about it. If you go back and you read, Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith's book, actually his book Theory of Moral Sentiments is an even better book, about the deficiencies of capitalism. But basically, both of them point out in both those books that what produces wealth for the nation, what produces a strong middle class, although that's not a phrase that Adam Smith used, but social stability as a result of general wealth among working people, which is a paraphrase of things that Adam Smith actually said, mostly in Theory of Moral Sentiments, is wages. And wages are what drive demand. Wages, in fact, are so much drive demand. In other words, if you have money in your pocket, you go out and buy things. When you buy things, the companies that sell those things have to buy more of them. The companies that manufacture things have to make more of them. The companies that manufacture those things have to hire people to make those things, or they have to buy more robots to make those things, in which case the robot manufacturers have to hire people to make the robots, whatever. That you having money in your pocket is what drives the economy because it drives demand. And that's so much the case that economists don't refer to wages as wages. They refer to wages as aggregate demand, right? The sum of all the demand in the economy is the sum of all the wages in the economy minus basic living expenses like rent. So, that's been our understanding. Adam Smith, 1776, Wealth of Nations, 1781, he published Theory of Moral Sentiments. Then you go to David Ricardo, 1809. David Ricardo, one of the great economists, his Iron Law of Labor maybe it was called the Iron Law of Wages, but he also wrote extensively on the impact of immigration diluting labor pools and the impact of unions. And David Ricardo pointed out the same thing. Wages are what drives the economy. Now, that was always believed to be the case. That was known to be the case. There's a million examples of that. Probably the best example is how Franklin Roosevelt got us out of the Great Depression. John Maynard Keynes said, if you hire, and the way that FDR did it was he put millions of people back to work, planting trees, building dams, just doing some things that were really, really productive. Other things, hiring painters, artists to do things like all the art that's in the Detroit Museum, the Detroit Art Institute right now, which is just mind-boggling. So, he put these people to work and gave them a paycheck. That paycheck then got us out of the Great Depression because it produced demand. And right. So, that's just like, Econ 101, right? And that everybody always understands. So what happened in 1980, in the early 1980s, in the early Reagan administration, was they wanted to come up with a rationalization for massively cutting the taxes on rich people. And so the theory was, if we cut taxes on rich people, and on businesses. They, you know, because when Reagan came into office, fully one third of all federal receipts, all the money that supports all of, you know, this is the reason why Eisenhower was able to build the national highway system, why during the Eisenhower administration we built thousands, tens of thousands of new schools, new hospitals, new roads, bridges, airports, all kinds, you know, and most of this infrastructure we're still using from the 1950s. The reason he was able to do this, one third of all the income was coming from corporate taxes. But they wanted to radically cut those corporate taxes and radically cut the taxes on the billionaires, and they had to come up with a rationalization for it. And so the rationalization they came up with was, if we cut taxes on these guys, they will produce more goods. They'll run their factories, you know, they'll be able to use that money to hire more people, expand their factories, and produce more goods. Now, why would that be a good thing if demand comes from wages? They're not talking about increasing wages. So by any measure of classical economics, literally from Aristotle through Adam Smith through John Maynard Keynes, and we were still in a Keynesian economy in 1981, by any rational, you know, that should be a completely meaningless and BS argument. So they came up with a new argument that said, well, if manufacturers manufacture more stuff, if there's more stuff on the shelves of the stores, then people will buy more stuff because it's available. If there's more supply, there will be more economic activity. And so instead of demand side, you know, the demand side driving the economy, they said these brilliant, you know, the Stephen Moore was actually one of the big proponents of this, said, well, actually it's supply side. We've got to incentivize the job creators and the billionaires and the big corporations by cutting their taxes, and they will make more goods, and that more goods flooding our stores. And this is also the rationalization that they use for opening the door to China. Cheap Chinese goods coming into the United States. There's more stuff. Walmart is filled with more stuff than they had before. It's all made in China, but it's cheap. And therefore, that will stimulate the economy. Now, 40 years on, we can look back and say this was complete BS. But that's the history of it, Dennis.
I got a question about the income for the, you know, different income groups in society. From 1940 to 1980, the top bottom 90% saw an income rise of 47%. From 1980 to today, it's actually declined by 3%. Could you explain why the incomes for the middle class have not risen like they used to post-World War II compared to post-1980?
Sure. There's a very, very simple explanation. We could get into the esoterica of the impact of tax cuts and things like that, but the really simple explanation for probably 80% of the effect is when Ronald Reagan came into office, about a third of Americans had a union job. They worked in union shops. The assault on unions had just begun when Reagan put an anti-union person in as Secretary of Labor, the first one in the history of our country, the first anti-union Secretary of Labor. He packed the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court started ruling against labor and started chipping away at union rights. And we have seen, and by the way, a union job sets the floor for jobs in the larger economy, you know, in the surrounding neighborhoods. And so when a third of America was unionized, two-thirds of America had an income and benefits package that was basically, you know, a union package, because, you know, regular employers had to compete with unionized employers for benefits, you know, for employees. And so when Reagan came into office, it was about two-thirds of America who had basically good union jobs. Now, in the private sector, it's 6% who have union jobs, which means 12% of America has good union jobs in the private sector. And, you know, that tells you pretty much everything you need to know, Dennis.
And also, I know that you say that the top marginal tax rate was also acted as a barrier for CEOs to raise the wages of their workers in companies. What would you say is the ideal, optimal top marginal tax rate? I know right now it's like 39%. What is the ideal?
Yeah, I think it's been reduced even from that. And in fact, you know, a lot of CEOs are reconfiguring their companies so that they can take their salaries and run it through their, run it as earned. I forget the phrase, but you know, it's down around 15%. My point is that top marginal income tax rate doesn't so much. It doesn't affect wages down in the bottom half of the scale. it causes CEOs to take less pay. Again, in 1980, when Reagan came into office, the average CEO pay was 30 times what the lowest paid employee in the company was. Today, depending on your industry, it's anywhere from 300 times to 10,000 times. And the reason why is because that cap got taken off. The tax rate when Reagan came into office was 74%, the top tax rate. Now, as you point out, it's 39% or in that neighborhood. The functional top tax rate is actually much, much lower than that as a result of all the loopholes that they put into it. So I would say anything over 50%. If you look around the world, you look at country after country after country, countries like Israel and Denmark that have relatively egalitarian societies with less income inequality, less disparity in incomes, they have top income tax rates over 50%. And it works fine for them. They're not in a crisis. Their economies are not falling apart. Their companies are doing well. They're tanking on the world. So I'd say
thank you, Tom.
50% does. You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
You know, one of the hopes we have is the rise in union membership. Basically, if the politicians are basically bought by the corporations up there on the Hill, and what happened?
Yeah, thanks to the Supreme
Court. That, yeah, with basically with Clinton came in and we weren't getting the money from the unions anymore. He started taking it from the bank. So if we could get strong union membership and people realize essential workers are essential, we need to pay them a living wage. You know, yeah. I think $15 an hour. We need to go to 20. You know,
well, it's not just a living wage, Jeff. If you gave people the right to unionize, you wouldn't have to worry about the minimum wage.
Well, Omar made a good point, and I hope you do bring that up to Rokana. Why doesn't the progressive part of the Democratic act like the Freedom Caucus or the Tea Party did back in the day? I mean, they hated the Tea Party because they would just say, no, we're not signing that. Why can't they have the oomph to behave like that? I mean, in the same sense. I don't know what they do. They say they're going to kill their kids when they get up there. I have some hope with that Bowman going in there. He seems pretty feisty, and I like that, you know. And
yeah.
AOC, it seems like they knocked her down a peg, and she's still out there fighting. But I just don't get it. I just, you know, so that's my rant.
Yeah, I get that, and I just wrote it down, so I'll bring it up with Congressman Khanna. And with regard to unionization, you know, most people don't realize Denmark, for example, has no minimum wage. And yet people at McDonald's make the equivalent of $18 an hour. And burgers are like 20 cents more than here, but, you know, it's infinitesimal because labor is not that big a piece of the cost of a burger. But the reason why they don't need a minimum wage in Denmark and several other of these Scandinavian countries and Northern European countries is because they have something like 80-90% unionization. Basically, there's no need for a minimum wage because, you know, everybody's negotiating their contracts, collectively. And it's really working. Ron in Minot, North Dakota. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Hey, thanks, Tom. A question for you. I just recently learned that the great saint of the, you know, the Adam Smith, the great saint of supply side and free market, that he actually wrote on feudalism, and he predicted or suggested that there would be a new age, a new feudal age would be the result of all this free market economy. I was surprised at that, and then thinking of this last election with people like Tom Steyer and Bloomberg, and then those are the overt ones. The covert ones are people like Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and Bezos and even Bill Gates. These are people with a lot of power because they have a lot of money. And I wonder, My question to you is, I know you're writing on that in a book, and my question is, has this come true? Are we in a new feudal age? And has money really destroyed our democracy? It's really being run by those with money. That's my question, and I'll sign off to what you say. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Ron. My answer is yes. the book that I have coming out in a month or so, The Hidden History of Monopolies, American Monopolies, How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream, is about how business has used that money to basically take over government. And then the book that's coming out next spring, The Hidden History of Oligarchy, and we haven't fine-tuned the title on that yet. I just submitted the book last week to the publisher.
for the final edits. That book is about how, because of those two Supreme Court decisions in 1976 and 1978, and I reference this in the book on the Supreme Court, the hidden history of the Supreme Court, the Buckley decision in 76 and the Bilotti decision in 78.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Those decisions said was, for the first time in the history of America, that billionaires or corporations owning politicians was not corruption or bribery, it was simply free speech, protected by the First Amendment. And that those two decisions in the mid-70s led directly to the Reagan Revolution. They led directly to the election of Ronald Reagan, massive amounts of billionaire money, foundation money, and corporate money going into the Reagan campaign in 1980, and have maintained the Republican Party all these years. And then Gillens and Page did this amazing study in 2013, and they looked at, starting in 1980, going forward. And what they found was that 1980 was basically the last year that the desires of the majority of Americans, as expressed in opinion polls, were being translated into legislation in the federal Congress. Ever since then, the majority of Americans, what the majority of Americans want, has not become law. Instead, what has become law is what the top 5% want. So we are now an oligarchy. We have ceased to be a democratic republic. We are an oligarchy. And the question that I raise in my book on oligarchy that'll be out in the spring is, can we revert back to a democratic republic? And I lay out a series of steps to do so in that book, which won't be out for 9 months, thereabouts, something like that. It's something I've given a lot of thought to, and I'm very concerned about it. So, yeah. And so the Monopoly book is basically how economic power gets concentrated in the United States and destroys small and medium-sized businesses and entrepreneurs. And then the Spring book is about how political power gets concentrated in the United States. John in Apple Valley, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind? Thanks for waiting on hold.
A lot of things, just like the lady that was on before, a lot of thoughts, but I'm limited to one, and so this is the one. I remember, and you're the historian, this is a history question. I remember when I was a young man, Carter was president, that the home loan interest rates were like 15-17%. It was really outrageous. And I'm just wondering if...
Yeah, we had a 13% mortgage during those years.
Well, but I'm just wondering if the banks were part of the reason and the way they ravaged the economy with that, or the home buying anyway, real estate business, if that was part also of the fall of Mr. Carter, President Carter. I mean, if the banks were in on it, and that's why they did it. That's kind of my thought. I don't know. And that's why I'm asking you, the historian.
Sure. Yeah. No, that was not the case. What had happened was, let me just back up and give you an abstract lesson in, or story about how inflation happens. Inflation, which is the debasement of currency, the reduction in value of a currency, happens from one of two reasons, typically. Either one, the government produces more currency than there is need for the currency, so they flood the market with that currency, and the value of every dollar goes down because there's more dollars in circulation. That has never happened in the United States, but that's by and large what happened in Germany after World War I with the hyperinflation. And you could argue that's what happened in Zimbabwe. But the second thing that caused hyperinflation, that also was the major contributor actually to the German hyperinflation, is if a commodity was, which is absolutely essential to the functioning of an economy, becomes very, very scarce, the price of that economy, that commodity explodes. And therefore, that explosion in price of that one commodity echoes through the rest of the economy, driving up prices. And that happened in Germany with regard to food after World War I. There was actually a mini famine. And that happened in the United States with regard to oil in the early 70s as a result of two oil Arab oil embargoes. And so what happened was the price of oil exploded in the United States. In fact, it more than quadrupled in 1 year. And that then, because almost everything is made out of oil, even our food is made out of oil, because oil, you know, they make fertilizer out of oil. Oil fuels the machines that we use to you know, tractors and things. It gets our food to us, you know, by trucks and things. Oil affects everything. And so that radical increase in the price of oil as a result of the Arab oil embargo drove inflation in the United States. So to reduce inflation, the chairman of the Fed said, we need to slow the economy down. We need to induce a mini recession, which will produce deflation. It'll reduce prices and increase the value of the dollar. And so he raised interest rates in order to slow down the economy. And that's what was going on. The rise in interest rates throughout the late 70s was purely done by the Fed, and it was purely done to try to slow down the economy so that we didn't tip into a worse inflationary spiral. There are people who argue that that was not the proper remedy, or that, you know, it shouldn't have been done that way, or it should have been done more slowly, and, you know, that hurt Carter, and it's one of the reasons Reagan won. But the bottom line is that's why it happened. Richard in Pasadena, California. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
What's on my mind is whether or not we're feudal serfs and our police department. I have a quote, if you'll let me read it, from a 1787. The means of defense against foreign dangers historically have become the instruments of tyranny at home. Throughout all Europe, the armies kept under the pretext of defending have enslaved the people.
Yeah, it sounds like something that Jefferson or some of his anti-army colleagues would have said.
Yeah, James Madison.
James Madison, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Jefferson's protege. Absolutely. And this is why they put into the Constitution that the entire Congress every 2 years has to decide again every 2 years whether they want to have a standing army during times of peace. Now, we haven't had a time of peace in quite some time, but, the two-year requirement still stands. And, I think to a large extent we have become feudal serfs, and I think that that's probably a pretty good analogy, feudalism and serfdom.
So, yeah, we're enslaved, for sure. Yeah. Hey, can I say just one more thing about Richard Wolff the other day said that there are... there were 315 million billionaires before the pandemic, and then they've added 15 billionaires since. I'm wondering, isn't there one common sense billionaire who can fund Pacifica Radio and free speech radio and television? I mean, this is crazy that this is out in the limb like
that. Wouldn't that be nice? No, it was a group of oligarchs who helped put together the Rush Limbaugh show. It was oligarchs who took over, iHeartRadio, also known as Clear Channel back in the day. It was oligarchs who took over Cumulus Radio. It was oligarchs Comcast oligarchs who took over NBC. To the best of my knowledge, I have not seen any left-wing oligarchs exhibit any interest in media. And in fact, I wrote an open letter to Tom Steyer back a year ago, maybe thereabouts, you know, during the primaries, in which I said, you know, if you're going to put your money and efforts into something instead of running for president, you should buy iHeartRadio. And at that particular point, it was for sale. And it was for sale for about $1.1 billion. and it would have made a great investment. I mean, you know, it'll actually produce revenue. It'll make money if it's well run. And, you know, you could put good progressive programming on it. And he never responded to that. I think it's real unfortunate, Richard. Ralph Nader, who wrote the foreword to my new book on monopoly back 6, 8, 10 years ago, wrote a book called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us Now, in which he basically argued that because the Supreme Court has enabled oligarchy in the United States so that we now have government run of, by, and for super rich people, that the super rich people of goodwill are going to have to step up and step in and make things happen. And to a large extent, George Soros has been doing that much of his life, but he's been doing it on the world stage, and he's been doing it with big issues like the fate and future of democracy, small d democracy. But in terms of getting your hands dirty, you know, like Charles Koch has done his entire life, I'm not seeing that on the left, and I think it's a real tragedy. Richard, thank you for the call. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman. Hi, Tom Hartman here with you. Janine on the Big Island in Hawaii. Hey, Janine, we were just talking about your island. Donald Trump seems to think that you shouldn't be so safe there.
Right. I am so glad you brought that up because it's not getting a lot of attention, and it's, I don't know if it's ironic or what, that he's threatened that the same day that New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut are wanting to do the same thing.
Right.
So I'm hoping that they can kind of help back us, because we've been totally successful here. And the thing that made the difference with us, in addition to the quarantining, was the masks. It was like, as soon as our governor implemented everybody to wear masks, and everybody had, that's when our curve dropped down to almost zero, right after the masks.
Wow.
It's all about the masks.
Was that back in
March?
But
beyond that, he implemented it in March, towards the end of March, about the 25th or so.
Yep.
So it's been a miracle, and most everybody here has been compliant.
Mm-hmm. And you said, but beyond that?
But beyond that, on Saturday, when Trump was giving his speech in Arizona, I heard him say something that no one else has mentioned. I'm wondering if you have heard of this. It was the same day, that morning, Twitter flagged him for some of his stuff on Twitter. He was mad. And during his speech, he said he was issuing an executive order to stop the liability for social media companies, the liability protection for people suing them.
Section 210 of the Telecommunications Act, as I recall. Yeah.
I knew you would know, but I don't know much about this, but I think I recall hearing Mark Zuckerberg say that if it wasn't for that protection, he would never have been able to even start Facebook.
Well, he could have started it. It just wouldn't have gotten to where it is with as much profit. I wrote an op-ed about this a few weeks ago. Myself and a couple of friends of mine, Sue Nethercutt, Nigel Peacock, Brad Walrod, the four of us basically ran 30-some-odd forums for CompuServe back in the 1980s and the early 1990s. And CompuServe paid us good money. I mean, we made a really good living at it for a while there to moderate the forums. I had 34 different forums on CompuServe. I ran the IBM PC support forum, the Macintosh support forum, the ADD support forum, the JFK assassination forum, the International Trade Forum, just a bunch of them. People posted messages because CompuServe could be held liable if somebody posted something that was defamatory or threatening or whatever. You know, we had to basically read every message. And I mean, there was a certain window within of reasonableness. You know, if somebody posted something and we didn't catch it within a few hours, we were in trouble. So we had, you know, 24-hour staffing, basically, which is why CompuServe paid us as well as they did. But we caught that stuff. All that ended in 1996, and our gravy train, essentially, our job ended in 1996 with the passage of the Telecommunications Act, because CompuServe was no longer responsible for the content that people posted on their forums, on their sites. And that is why Facebook is doing, and Twitter, that's why they are where they are. And what I suggested in this op-ed was that we should blow up Section 210 or 310, whichever it is, this part of the Telecommunications Act of 96 that gives immunity to people who have message boards on you know, which is Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, social media, and their immunity. Mark Zuckerberg is worth $75 billion. If he had to pay people like Nigel and Brad and me and Sue to basically moderate all of the various Facebook content, he might only be worth $70 billion. I mean, it's not the amount of money that CompuServe was paying us. I know it was peanuts compared to the amount of money they were raking in. They were such a huge profit center that H&R Block bought them and sucked them dry. And so, you know, and Trump now is using this as a cudgel against Facebook, because mostly people on the left have been saying,
who has the biggest history of lawsuits being filed in America? It's Donald Trump loves filing lawsuits.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And what if he just sues
the heck out of Facebook and Twitter until they're bankrupt?
He can't sue them because of this immunity that was provided by the Telecommunications Act. But if he can get Congress to undo that immunity,
he said he just wrote an executive order removing it.
Right.
In the speech.
See, I know that it's not being reported
anywhere.
But see, he doesn't have that power, Janine. He doesn't have that power. I mean, this is, you know, keep in mind, this is a guy who on an average day tells 18 consequential lies. So, you know, he was lying to people. This is his way of trying to threaten Zuckerberg and you know, the guy who runs Twitter, Jack Dorsey, I think is his name. He's basically trying to threaten them to say, you know, support me and trash my opponents, essentially. So that's what's going on. Janine, I got to run, but thank you for the call. Thanks for the report from Hawaii. It's fascinating to hear that your governor back in March ordered everybody on the island to wear masks, and boom, your transmission rate just collapsed. That's the same thing Austria, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic have seen. We could here, too. Bob in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was wondering what you thought about forced wealth redistribution.
I'm generally speaking in favor of it.
I know it's been in the news lately with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie and the taxes on the wealthy, but we've also had forced wealth distribution for decades in this country, because if you, say, are a machinist for a major airline, just as an example, and you put your pension money away, or they do it for you for years, you're getting ready to retire, they're feeling poor, they declare bankruptcy. They don't have to change the CEO. They don't have to change the board members. They don't have to shut down. They don't have to move the headquarters. They just sign some papers. And your life savings disappears and becomes theirs overnight.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking,
you know who pioneered this?
Matching funds. I'm talking money that was part of your wage that you paid taxes on already.
That's correct. You're absolutely right. And Reagan legalized this in the early 1980s. And Carl Icahn, who is one of Donald Trump's best friends and advisors, Carl Icahn was the guy who really pioneered this with the TWA bankruptcy. First the acquisition, then the bankruptcy, stripping it of its pension funds. Then they did it with Eastern Airlines. This was back in the late 80s, as I recall. And then they did it with Eastern. And then, you know, I think American Airlines went through this at one point. They got rid of their pension funds. And it's not just the airlines. This is now all across American industry. And Mitch McConnell yesterday, when he was talking about blue state bailouts, said that the blue states, their public employee unions, have negotiated pensions. Blue states pay pensions to their state employees. Some red states do. Most red states don't. And the blue states are paying pensions. And Mitch McConnell came right out and said, we're not going to bail out your pension funds. I mean, it's like, to hell with workers. That's the official mantra of the Republican Party.
Wealth distribution and how terrible it is when we want to tax the rich. But we've been wiping people out legally, taking their own money. Just because the company feels poor because they had their hands on it. And, you know,
yeah,
it's just
like
we talk about welfare and welfare abuses. But is a welfare abuse maybe Walmart taking millions of dollars in property tax concessions and setting up in a town? And then as soon as that wears out, they jump across.
Now, corporate welfare is just fine. These guys, Bob, thank you for the call. These guys are all in favor of corporate welfare. They go for corporate welfare all day long. Right. That's you just saw $2 trillion of it. But human beings being benefited by government policy. Oh, my God, we can't have that. Elwin in Seattle. Hey, Elwin, what's on your mind today?
About the notices and things that workers are getting threatening to cut off their unemployment if they don't go back to work. Yeah, that's right out of the Labor Department. What nobody is telling these people is that they have a right to refuse dangerous job assignments. There are certain conditions. This comes out of an OSHA regulation that the Supreme Court upheld in 1980. I know you're running short. I don't want to take up a lot of your time. But what I want to do is send you some information, and I would encourage you to get someone on your program from the National Employment Law Project, which wrote to the Labor Department, told them they were wrong. They wanted them to put out public clarification of these statements that they've been making. And they also reminded them that workers do have a right to additionally collect unemployment if there is a legitimate hazard of, you know, in the workplace that they're being told they have to go back to. New York Times had an article last week about workers actually being fired for doing what they have a right to do. So I would be happy to send you some information. I do hope you follow up with the...
After you called last week, Kathy, I looked into this, and you're absolutely right. And we do have that right. And, you know, just like in Texas, theoretically, you have the right to vote if you think that vote by mail, if you think that showing up in person will harm your health. Problem is, tell that to a worker who just got fired. Tell that to a person who can't get their unemployment check, that their only remedy is through the courts, because that's really all they can do. So they're going to have to go out and find a lawyer who's willing to defend them for probably no payment whatsoever. And when you sue the government, you don't end up with punitive damages or anything like that that'll incentivize a lawyer. And these guys at the Department of Labor, Eugene Scalia, I mean, he's a slick lawyer himself. His dad was the head of the Supreme Court, right? He was on the Supreme Court. They know this. They're just playing a damn game that they're going to continue to play right up until January, you know, when Trump leaves office, assuming, God willing, he does. And, you know, we can say all day long, you have the right to get your unemployment check, but that doesn't mean it's going to come. You have the right not to go to work and not lose your job. But, you know, I mean, the remedies are simply not there if the administration is refusing to enforce the black letter law, the clear law.
Well, yeah, I wrote an article about that. I've got two out there, one on the Progressive Media Project, got distributed via the Tribune News Service, another one for the...
But is there a solution that I'm missing here, Kathy?
Well, no, here's one thing. The way that when I was researching this thing, OSHA has a process. This is all out of OSHA. Okay, so what the worker is supposed to do, if they believe they have a good faith and all that kind of stuff, they can withhold, and then they can say, I'll call OSHA, and OSHA come in, make a determination. Problem is, OSHA is hugely understaffed, and they can't get out
there. Right, and this could take a year.
Yeah, but in the meantime, if there hasn't been a finding that the workplace is safe, that kind of takes away any argument that the worker has to...
I agree with you. You're going to win the argument, but you're going to lose the job and the income. Kathy, thank you for the call. Jeffrey D. Sachs, a university professor, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, has produced some just absolutely extraordinary work over the years. The Age of Sustainable Development back in 2015, Building a New American Economy in 2017, A New Foreign Policy Beyond American Exceptionalism. He has a new book out. His website, by the way, Jeff Sachs, SACHS.org. You can tweet him at Jeff D. Sachs. He has a new book out. It's called Ages of Globalization, and it's fascinating, thought-provoking, in-depth analysis of kind of a history of globalization going back 70-some-odd thousand years ago. Professor Sachs, welcome back to the program. It's been a while. Thank you for writing this new book and for joining us.
Tom, I hope you're well. How are you doing?
I am. Yes, knock wood. So you go through the seven ages of globalization, the Paleolithic, the Neolithic, the Equestrian, the Classical Age, the Ocean Age, the Industrial Age, and now the Digital Age. Give us a snapshot of what you're talking about here. Explain what you mean by this.
The idea is to try to understand how humanity has related with each other, especially through trade and migration, long-distance spread of ideas throughout human history. When I was first studying economics many decades ago, I thought, my God, we are opening a new period called globalization. It took me quite a while to understand that while there are unique aspects of our globalization compared to the past, we've been at this global affair for quite a long time. And to understand the dynamics of global change, I came to understand over the course of my career and policy work that you really did need to understand the interactions of geography, the climate, the physical resources, the location of economies, how those interacted with the institutions of government, politics, and so forth, with fundamentally the changes of our know-how, our technologies, perhaps the most fundamental driver of change of them all. And in this overview of human globalization, of long-distance interactions, I emphasize this three-way understanding, taking physical nature, technological change, and ideas, culture, politics as three sides that are constantly interacting. I believe it helps us to understand what's happening right now, which is mass disruption to our lives, our understanding, our nature of global interaction. So that's the purpose of the book.
What does this mean for us today?
What I think is stunning and upsetting and unnerving is that we are absolutely entering a new phase of globalization. Many days in the COVID pandemic we hear, is globalization over? Are we reverting to national or local economies? The answer is certainly not, especially in an age driven by digital technologies, which are instantaneously bringing knowledge and all aspects of our economic life within global reach. So we're not reverting to any kind of local economics. We're more interconnected than ever, and that's a basic truth. But what's also happening is that we are experiencing a deep disruption to how our economies work. COVID is obvious. We couldn't be more dramatic, of course, but what it has done is to dramatically accelerate the digitalization of every aspect of our economic life. Most of us are working from home. Payments, commerce, governance is all now online. Not all of it, of course, but a remarkable amount. Within a few weeks, hundreds of millions of kids went to school online, completely unexpectedly. But while with lots of difficulties more seamlessly than one could have imagined over the course of just a few weeks. At the same time, global politics is changing absolutely rapidly, again, in this case, accelerated both by the pandemic and by Trump, who is the most incoherent and narrow-minded president we've ever had. He's actually accelerating what was already underway, which is the end of the American-led global era to now a truly multipolar global era where China, East Asia more generally, India, Africa, Europe are each more independently acting and interacting regions. So I think we're entering a new kind of geopolitics. The U.S. has basically abandoned leadership under the weird and unhelpful banner of America First, which is getting us deeper and deeper into trouble on many fronts. But even beside that point, we are now in a different kind of global politics. Much of the day-to-day conflict that we're seeing with China or the rhetorical skirmishing with China is really a reflection of this global change. The third aspect of our global reality, of course, is nature itself. COVID-19 is only the most recent of a wave of emerging new diseases that reflect in a fundamental way how humanity is impinging on nature and thereby triggering new so-called zoonotic events where pathogens, viruses, bacteria, and so forth spread from animal populations to human populations. In this case, from bats to humans, probably somewhere in southwest China originally. But this is just one of a series of such pandemics, SARS and Ebola and Middle East Respiratory Syndrome being three other recent zoonotic emergent diseases. And sad to say, there will be more to come. But that's part of an even larger environmental story, of course, Tom. As you know, climate change, mass pollution, destruction of the biosphere. In short, we are in a new global era, which will change fundamentally how we live, how we interact, and what we have to do to stay safe.
It's remarkable. We have just a little less than a minute left, and you've raised so many large issues here. I'm wondering your thoughts on the emergence of digital oligarchs, essentially. Zuckerberg and Facebook have now said that science about climate change is going to be treated like opinion on Facebook, so climate change deniers can do whatever they want. Is this new digital age going to be one that's controlled by an oligarchy, essentially?
We are in the robber baron era of the new digital economy, where Bezos and Zuckerberg and a few others think they call the shots, and for the short term, they do. I don't think this will last long. It is phenomenal that in a short period of time, Bezos gained $50 billion in the few weeks of this pandemic. It's not going to last. We're going to be taxing them, we're going to be regulating them, and we're going to be regarding these technologies as a common ownership of humanity, not the ownership of a few people.
From your lips to God's ears, Professor Jeffrey D. Sachs, the new book, Ages of Globalization. Thank you, sir.
Good to be with you. Thank you so much,
Tom. Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. Professor Sachs, extraordinary book. I spent several hours with it yesterday. It is fascinating. Teresa in Pahoa, Hawaii.
About Hawaii being owned by foreign countries and stuff. Well, I got rid of squatters next door to me and found out that my research, it was owned by the Deutsche Bank. Then it got sold to Ukrainian bank, which aired it the property on Zillow. That got bought by a Chinese fella who's specializing in Section 8 housing and pet-friendly houses.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, this is happening all over the place. Thank you for that anecdote, Teresa. That, you know, you're validating my story. I really appreciate it.
Exactly.
And thank you for watching us there in Hawaii. Lynn in Mobile, Alabama. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
I'm calling in regard to imported goods from China and places like that. When Jeff Sessions was my senator, he introduced legislation to remove the requirement of places of origin for products coming into the United States. I don't know whether it ever got out of committee or not. I called his office to register concern and complain about it, and they were very cavalier and said they did not know anything about it and sent me a letter thanking me for inquiring about something entirely different. But the point I want to make is I'm very fond of pineapple, and I haven't been able to find a Del Monte or Dole product pineapple that is not packaged and produced in China or Thailand or the Philippines. And so my concern is that Jeff Sessions may have been motivated by money, obviously. It's possible that someone else will come along and motivate some other senator to try to introduce this legislation again, and then I won't have access to that information.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, this is what happens when the Supreme Court says that it's okay for corporations to own American politicians, and which they did back in the 70s, and that led right to Reagan and the Reagan Revolution, and it's been off to the races ever since. Lynn, thank you for the call, and thank you for sharing your perspective with us. Thank you for being with us these 3 hours today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, and in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require the active participation of all of us, frankly. You know, please, you know, share good progressive media with your friends and get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Be good to yourself and others.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.